Hi, everybody, and welcome to the DCVC podcast. I'm your host, Akash Bhatt, and this is a show where I bring you leading angel investors and venture capitalists investing in the diverse tech landscape around the world. I'm very excited about this week's episode because we're set to explore for the very first time the tech ecosystem that is developing just on the other side of the border. With me on the show today is our very first guest from Pakistan, Misbah Naqvi. She is the co-founder and general partner at i2i Ventures, an early-stage VC fund investing in tech startups solving problems for Pakistan. Pakistan's tech ecosystem has had an interesting journey over the last couple of years, with last year particularly being the best in terms of VC funding. I felt it was time for the podcast to truly be Desi and explore the venture ecosystems that fall under the Desi umbrella. So in today's episode, we will cover the fundamental changes that have occurred in Pakistan's tech ecosystem and why the country has put itself on the venture map, even attracting the likes of Y Combinator, Tiger Global, and Kleiner Perkins to its doorstep. This is a fantastic episode for anyone wanting to get a glimpse into Pakistan's landscape, and most importantly, for anyone within the country to understand the development from someone close to the ground. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Misbah. Misbah, welcome to the podcast. I'm really, really excited to have you here today. You're the first Pakistani VC to be on the Desi VC podcast as we expand the realms of the show itself. So really glad to have you and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Akash. I'm delighted to be here. I'm really excited to be the first Pakistani VC talking to you. Hope you'll have many more on the show as you go along. But looking forward to our conversation, and thanks so much for having me.
I'm really looking forward to bringing more Pakistani VCs on the podcast, simply because I want people to understand both from within the Pakistani ecosystem as well as those outside to see what a vibrant ecosystem it's turning out to be. And the little study that I've done over the last few months really tells me how far the ecosystem's come along. And that's one of the things that I want to sit down and have a conversation with you. But before we get into all of that, I really want to go a little bit back into the past and talk about how everything's kind of turned out for you personally. So if you could rewind the clock a little bit and really take us through your journey and how you eventually ended up in venture capital, I think that'll be great for all of our listeners to get a glimpse of your story.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm basically from Karachi, grew up over here, did my MBA back when MBAs were still cool, although my partner insists that they still are, but I'm not so sure. So did my MBA in 97 and graduated and started with Citigroup as my first job. Corporate banking was all the rage at the time in Pakistan, and foreign banks like Citibank were doing really well. So I joined Citi, started in corporate banking, worked in transaction banking as well as corporate finance, managed a $100 million loan book, and then at some point realized I didn't really want to be a banker when I grew up, so to speak. And so I moved into a public affairs sort of chief of staff kind of role with the CEO of Citibank in Pakistan at the time, where I got more exposure to both the regulatory landscape as well as, you know, the Citigroup Foundation as they were looking at development projects in Pakistan, internal and external communications, et cetera. And that's where I came across impact investing and Acumen, which at the time was Acumen Fund, which is a social venture fund. They raise philanthropic money and then they invest it through a double bottom line investing approach in social enterprises across different sectors, including healthcare, housing, finance and financial inclusion, agriculture, energy, water and sanitation, et cetera. So what my experience with Acumen was great. They were just starting out. I was a second employee, helped build the team and the portfolio, but that allowed me to see Pakistan at a real grassroots level. And to be honest, something that I hadn't seen firsthand before. And I got a chance to go into basties, into low-income communities and understand how people made decisions, where the gaps were in terms of access to goods and services, how much rent seeking really happens at the base of the pyramid, but also, you know, the mass market opportunity, like what the vast majority of Pakistan, Pakistani population does and does not have access to. So really was an eye-opener from that perspective. Moved with them to New York. I was with them in New York for a few years. And at some point, I joined a fintech startup out of the US, focused on secure authentication, but looking at global markets. So in a global role, I was actually looking at frontier and emerging markets in Africa, Asia, Middle East, etc., including Pakistan. And that gave me not only an appreciation for life in a startup, because I was employee number two there again, so very, very early days. Actually 2.5, but not only did I get a better understanding of how hard it is for startups and to be in a startup early team, but also recognized how hard it is to build in frontier markets and emerging markets where, and Pakistan obviously is one of them. And along with that, understanding, you know, fintech and more of exposure to the technology side of things, was with them for a few years as well. In parallel, I've been, on the advisory board of Invest to Innovate, which actually my partner in the fund, Kusum Lakhani, founded a decade ago. So I've been involved with that company for the last decade, and they were Pakistan's first startup accelerator, as well as a company that works on the research and insight side. So over the last few years, we've actually been working with startups, as well as training other incubators and accelerators, not only in Pakistan, but also regionally. And then we're focused on putting out research for the ecosystem in Pakistan more broadly. So by association with that organization, I was actually getting exposure to the startup space over the last decade. And then a few years ago, when Kusum decided to set up a venture fund as a sister entity to Invest to Innovate, which is the accelerator, she asked if I would want to join her. I was taking a sabbatical. I thought I'd have a year of investing in myself, sitting on a beach, maybe reading things, catching up on life after 20 years of working nonstop. But that was cut short just after 3 months. I have no regrets there. But so I decided to join her. And together we founded I2I Ventures, which is now the VC fund where I am a co-founder and GP. And happy to share a little bit more about that through our conversation.
Love how that story has kind of turned out. And before we go ahead, I just want to mention this quickly and correct me here if I'm wrong, Ms. Pa, but just wanted to get all of our listeners to understand what double bottom line investing basically means. It's essentially an emerging field of impact investing where you're hoping to not just get a financial return from an investor point of view, but also hoping that your money can contribute back to a social cause, save resources, or contribute to an effort that they care about the society in one way or the other. The possibilities here could be, you know, endless, anything from poverty alleviation to affordable housing to natural resource conservation. And perhaps what's just kind of like very top of mind for a lot of people right now is, you know, global warming and climate change. So that's basically what double bottom line investing basically means. But now coming back to you, Ms. Pa, you know, you really talked about having spent a lot of time here in the US, then going back, being part of an early stage fintech organization before being an advisor and then going out to launch this fund. What experience, in your opinion, has kind of like really been rewarding for you in terms of setting you up for a role as a VC? The only reason I ask this question is when people are listening to this from Pakistan and around the world, I really want them to get a sense of what are some of the traditional paths and non-traditional paths that people end up taking to get to venture? Because when you take a look at it from outside, typically people will say that you need a finance background. Hey, this person spent a lot of time, you know, in the financial industry, and therefore maybe they understand the space really, really well. But we've seen that the narrative is changing so much within venture capital. Today, you don't have to be from either a technical background or a finance background to either set up a fund or find a job within venture. You can be from the arts and humanitarian background and you can still be part of the venture capital industry. So in your experience, if you're putting things in retrospect and looking back at how your professional life's kind of played out, what is that thing that kind of set you up for a career in VC?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Akash. And I think it speaks to the broader, what we're calling now the democratization of VC globally, right? I think for me, it's not a path, it's a non-linear path. It's not something that if you'd asked me even 10 years ago, I would have seen myself doing. It's only with hindsight that I look back now and I think, like everything that I've done, every role that I've sort of played in, whether in a large you know, 300,000 person corporate like Citigroup or a 2.5 person startup, which is 4 months old, I think in some way or the other has led to who I am as an investor. And I think even though, you know, it is nonlinear, I can piece that story looking backwards now, because I've been on all sides of the table, right? I've been on the side of the table, which is writing, you know, millions of dollars worth of checks previously. I've been on the side of the table, which is trying to evaluate what are the opportunities in the mass market in a country like Pakistan, which is really, you know, where the money and the opportunity is at. And then I've also actually got my hands dirty through the operating experience. I think increasingly we're seeing in venture people coming with diverse backgrounds, like you said. It's a little bit of the realization that, you know, in order to make good bets on people, it really is about people first, and then recognizing opportunities. For us, because we're early stage investors, the founders play such a key role in how we make our investment decision to actually come into a company, that evaluation of a good or a bad founder is actually, you know, is really helped by my background, because I've, again, given the diversity of what my experience has been like, I'm able to pinpoint certain traits. My partner and I, Kulsoom, and I often joke about this, you know, we used to call it gut, but I think it's pattern recognition. And after a while of being in different roles, you start seeing what works and what doesn't. So again, my firsthand operator experience helps me empathize with founders, but also helps me recognize, you know, smell, you know, crap if it's coming my way, because I've been there and I've seen it. I think one of the things that we joke about on the team is that I'm the fintech cynic or the grumpy granddad a lot of times when we're talking to potential fintech investees, because I'm asking the hard questions, right? And I'm asking the hard questions because I've been there. I know how hard it is to build on the ground. And I think that kind of perspective helps me empathize a lot with founders, but helps me see when people are glossing over operationalizing something that, you know, where the devil really is in the details. So I think it's that aspect of being an operator, which is really important. I think you also have to understand the broader regulatory landscape. You have to understand where the market is at, where the country is at, what the opportunities are. And I think that kind of expectation and that kind of understanding and experience is not just limited to people that are from the finance space. I do think you need to understand investing, but that's something that can be learned, right? You can learn hard finance skills, or you can have somebody on the team that's going to help you kick the tires on a financial model. But if you're actually, especially at the early stage, investing in founders, you really need to be able to evaluate those founders, their ability, or your actually, you know, sort of your conviction in whether or not they can build, and then the market opportunity that they're targeting. And that market opportunity also is, you know, in the Pakistan context, looking at big problems around us that need to be solved. So it's not rocket science, to be honest. I think the finance aspect of it can be learned. There can be people on the team that help model out certain things, you know, whether you're talking about portfolio construction or whether you're talking about a return analysis for an investee company or a potential investee company. So I think it's not that hard to get access to those finance skills. I think what's harder is building that investment thesis. And to be honest, even though I came to this with, you know, over 20 years of experience, I have learned so much in the last 2.5 years of being an investor that I'm not the investor I was when I started out 2 years ago. And I think that journey is something that also speaks to how much you can learn once you're actually in the space.
Well, there's a lot that you touched upon there, which I couldn't, you know, agree more with. But one of the things that you touched upon was talking about your experience being an operator. Now, this is a much debated subject within venture as such, right? And you'll mm-hmm. also hear a lot of founders talking about this in closed forums. When you're talking about taking money from a VC, having had that operator experience definitely helps from an empathy standpoint. And then you have the other side of the coin in the debate where a lot of people say you don't really have had to like build anything to be a part of venture capital. Which side of the coin do you stand on today?
Wow, that's a tough one. I actually think it really helps. I don't think it's a must, But I think it helps because, like I was saying, you know, you have empathy for founders because you understand what they're going through. But then you also understand the questions to ask. And I think being on the operator side, you realize how important it is to ask the right questions. It's not important to have the right answers always. I think it's those are things that you can find your way through if you have, you know, a good team, if you have advisors, if you have an open mindset, if you're open to feedback, if you're a learner. Those are things as a founder that you can navigate over time with the right community around you, with the right mindset and approach yourself. But I think, you know, just having that openness comes from having been in that space yourself. And I think it's important to ask the right questions and help founders navigate as they're going through all of this. I think there are two aspects to having that operator background. I think one is making the investment decision, which you already touched upon. I think there being an operator definitely helps. I think it also helps in portfolio support, right? As investors, at least at I2I Ventures, we're very conscious about not being helicopter investors, not being, you know, not hovering over our startups, but actually helping them and enabling them as they navigate, you know, their own sort of strategy, their landscape, and what they need to do to succeed in their space. And that sometimes means recognizing that we don't have the answers either, but that we can help them think through some of those questions. So I think that operator experience, I don't think it's a must, but I think it's important. And even if we talk about the venture space more broadly, now, Akash, you were talking about, you know, how the types of venture investors has also started changing. And there are many more, there's much more diversity, which I think is definitely a good thing, not only in terms of gender and ethnic backgrounds, but also just in terms of various experiences. I think as that is happening, we're starting to see more of these angel operators coming in and having an operator background and just making small investments where they're able to help people that are raising VC funding in a way that, you know, maybe other investors can't. And that also speaks to the fact that operators themselves can add a lot of value. So I think to your question, while I don't think it's a must, I do think it's definitely a positive and definitely helps as you make investment decisions and then as you help your investee companies grow.
I think that's a fantastic point that you made. And it's a great transition into the next segment, where I was hoping to really talk about the ecosystem and the landscape of venture in Pakistan right now. But I think you set us up really well talking about angel investors and obviously operator VCs, kind of like been a very hot subject all over the world, maybe like 3 years ago or so when the whole term operator VC was coined. We kind of like saw this in the past, but didn't really have like a proper terminology for it. Now, looking at the landscape in Pakistan, what's kind of driving some of this innovation and the need and want to be investing in early stage companies in your side of the world?
Yeah, such a great question. And, you know, I'm so glad that you're asking that as a first question that we're talking about in the Pakistan context, because this really has been one of the main reasons why the Pakistan startup space and the VC space, the tech ecosystem has taken off in the last 2 years. Just as a sidebar, Pakistani startups raised, you know, $350 million this year, in 2021, a lot smaller than some of the other you know, markets around, especially India. But it's more than five times what they raised the year before that. They raised only 60 million in 2020 and 66 million in 2020 and 47 in 2019. So, you know, this 2021 has really been a marquee year for the Pakistan tech ecosystem. And one of the main reasons for that, I mean, there are several reasons which we can come to, but the founders and what is happening on the founder side has been really one of the reasons that this has grown exponentially. And what's really interesting is that, you know, when you say that you can't, you know, you can't aspire towards something that you don't see in front of you. I think we've had some great role models recently. You know, as you know, Kareem had an exit, which was a regional mobility startup, had an exit when Uber bought it for $3 billion. Now, Kareem is co-founded by a Pakistani, founded out of the UAE, but Pakistan has been one of the key markets that helped propel it forward. propel its growth forward. And it's been very visible in Pakistan. So not only were people able to associate with a Pakistani founder that did good, but they were also able to see this business model around them where, you know, not only was there a leveraging of the gig economy, people were getting jobs as drivers, but people were using the service. They were using this, you know, Uber-like service to go from one place to the other. And so the exposure to that on a firsthand basis, as well as, you know, the fact that a lot of people actually worked at Careem, had great experiences there. This was a fast-moving, very strong on operations startup. And those guys, a lot of them now have moved beyond, and this is not just Pakistan, I can say that for Egypt and Saudi as well, and some other regional markets, UAE included, that these people that were in the early days of Careem or in this, were in the team have actually now launched their own startups. And what they're bringing is a mindset change in terms of looking at the, unlocking the Pakistan opportunity through a fast-growing startup, through tech disruption. And these are people that actually have had strong operator background themselves, having done this you know, previously with a company like Careem. There are a few others as well in the e-commerce space. There's Daraz, there's, you know, Bikeya that's been around for a few years also, which is also looking at moving goods and people. So the point is that not only have founders got these kind of examples and this kind of experience, but because the interest in the startup space has grown, we're also seeing founders come from corporate backgrounds like Unilever or Nestle or even banking, and now are saying, wait, I've got like 5 to 7 years experience. I understand the market really well. Why don't I just start something on my own? Because I have a good sense of, you know, what the gaps are or what the opportunities are. So I think those are a couple of things on the founder side that we started seeing. There is a little bit of people sort of moving back to Pakistan. I don't think it's significant enough to be a real trend at this point. But I think there's, from the founder perspective, I think this kind of interest in building in Pakistan and recognizing the opportunity to address a market where so much is broken through technology and disruption has really been one of the key reasons why the space has grown so significantly in the last year. And then, you know, one other thing that I would say, and there are a couple of other reasons which I can touch upon as well, but one thing that's linked to this is increasing tech adoption during the pandemic. So we actually have, you know, we have a young population in Pakistan, you know, 60 to 70% under the age of 30 and growing. We have 100 million plus broadband users. So access to internet is available. It's quite cheap. And so tech adoption is increasing in any case, and then COVID just accelerated that as well. So I think on the customer side, we started seeing more sort of acceptability of tech models. And that coupled with the fact that people were building good models actually really, you know, pushed the market forward.
You made some fantastic points and laid out a comprehensive picture of what's kind of propelled the startup ecosystem in Pakistan. And, you know, going back to a couple of points that you hit on, especially last year was probably one of the most rewarding years for the country in terms of the funding that the startups were able to raise, upwards of $300 million, which has never happened in the past. And most importantly as well, there are certain sectors that have, you know, kind of done well, and you kind of touched upon those. COVID kind of helped support that expansion as well, and fashion being one, e-commerce being another, essential services being the other one out there. Now, when we are talking about upcoming economies and upcoming markets from a startup perspective, we obviously look firstly towards, you know, what the VCs are doing to support it. But secondly, most importantly, is the infrastructure, is what is the government doing? What are the local governments doing to support it? What kind of initiatives has the government taken to support this growth? The only reason I ask that is because I want to draw parallels to what happened in India. And I worked in the startup ecosystem about 12 years now. Wow, it seems like a long time, but 12 years ago, when NASSCOM set up 10,000 startups, 10,000 startups was an initiative with a long-term vision of impacting 10,000 companies over a span of 10 years plus through funding, incubation, acceleration, mentorship, and providing startups with any sort of a resource that would then help them launch companies and scale them further, which also involved bringing together the best-in-class VCs, giving them an opportunity to look at what's happening from the Indian landscape point of view, because India for a long time had been a talent exporter, but the government took a massive, massive bet on the startup ecosystem. And obviously the rewards are, you know, being seen now. About 12 years later, you've seen companies go public. You've obviously seen more unicorns come out of the country last year than ever before or in combined in history. So there were there was a huge role that the government played, both at the central and at the domestic level within each state. What is Pakistan doing in terms of helping support that growth from a perspective where tomorrow, if you look back at it and say, hey, back in 2020, these are the things that were set in place, and today Pakistan is where it is because of the initiatives that were taken. How closely do you think VCs also need to work with the stakeholders from a government and infrastructure point of view to really ensure that this is a robust, solid support system that can really help? And it's also, in a way, a cry to a lot of citizens to say, hey, don't go outside and build. There's a vibrant ecosystem that's kind of developing here, and it gives you a chance. You know, you pointed out to Kareem as a great example, even though it wasn't founded in Pakistan, the large user base was that are part of the country. So it's really pointing to all of these factors saying, you've got a vibrant ecosystem, you've got a great infrastructure, you obviously have a government that's supporting. Of course, the VCs are setting up funds here. You also have an opportunity now to take money from other foreign VC funds. We obviously saw Kleiner Perkins make its investment last year in Pakistan. So all of these factors are already pointing towards rosy image of what the ecosystem looks like today, and it can only get better in the times to come. So how would you kind of like put all of these pieces together and say there are certain things that still need to fall into place, but yeah, things are, you know, going in the right direction, but let's start out with the government and the infrastructural progress that Pakistan has made in the last few years.
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things that has been super helpful has been a supportive regulator, like regulatory landscape, a supportive government, especially in the last couple of years. And I'll answer two parts of your question together, because you also talked about, you know, lobbying and engaging on policy. And like I myself have been on several of these working groups with the central bank, which is the State Bank of Pakistan, and the SECP, which is the Securities and Exchange Commission, as they've looked at revamping some of the laws. So a couple of major things did happen in the last 2 years. One of them being that the State Bank actually allowed Pakistani startups to set up holding companies outside the country, which was not allowed previously. And that really did help accelerate the comfort level that foreign investors had putting money into Pakistani companies. They didn't have to put the money in directly into the country. They could actually put the money into holding companies abroad. That was pretty significant. I think along with that, there was some regularization around or easing up of regulations around exits and taking equity and dividends out of the country at the time of exit, which was clarified and made a little bit more conducive to growth. And then, you know, the SECP, for example, launched a sandbox where they work with, you know, NBFCs, non-banking financial companies, and others that are looking to try new business models in areas that may not have been covered by regulations previously, so that they can continue to co-create and work with the regulator as they grow the space. So a couple of these things have happened over the last 2 years or so that have actually helped. On the fintech side, there have been, you know, there's been more clarity on regulations. The electronic money institution regulations were introduced a few years ago. Just this year, but late last year, the digital banking regulations have been released as well. I kind of maybe think it was this year, it was a few weeks ago. And that has been through a process of engagement with stakeholders in the space. And I think that speaks to the government really looking at engaging with people and understanding what some of the major roadblocks are and how they can be eased up and removed. I think there's still a way to go. There are things like, you know, taxation, where there's an opportunity to incentivize digitization through a more sort of progressive tax policy. There's also an opportunity to, you know, ease up some of the structural, often bottlenecks that we see from a bureaucratic perspective for foreign investors or people that are putting money into Pakistani startups, just in terms of some of the KYC, et cetera, that needs to happen. It's pretty cumbersome as a process. But overall, I think there's been, you know, a positive attitude from the government side in trying to open up some of these regulations. And that really has had an impact on the Pakistani market. I think we are building the road in front of us as we go along to some extent. And what that means is that this is a continuous process and we will continue to engage with the government. We're just having, engaging on some policy discussions right now as well, where a few of us early stage, VCs are actually engaging with the government and giving our recommendations on policy. And again, it's great that the government is actually reaching out and asking for these because it shows that they are interested in kind of fostering this continuing sort of support for the startup space. So I think it's been positive so far. I also feel like to some extent, the genie's out of the bottle. When you open things up and you see what a positive impact it's having, it's hard to go back on some of those regulations and go back to the way things were before. But on this front, I'd say, Akash, that, from a regulatory perspective, just things have happened relatively, in the last year or so. We've been working on it for the last 2 years. But taking a step back and looking at the evolution of the ecosystem in the last decade, I would say that there have been other initiatives which have all led to this point as well. I mentioned our sister company is an accelerator that's been in the market for the last decade. Another accelerator that started around the same time was by the Punjab government. The Punjab IT board had set up Plan 9, which was an early incubator accelerator in Pakistan. And then the government subsequently engaged with the startup space by setting up Ignite, which actually has funded several incubation centers across the country. And what they've started doing over the last few years also is kind of encouraging talent to come into the space, helping founders get access to mentors and programs such as incubators and accelerators, across different cities, and they're continuing to grow their cohorts as well as the footprint in different cities. So some of this work, has been done, has been happening for a while. The Nest is another incubator that has been around for a while. And I think a lot of these things, like we joke and say it takes a village, but really has been a while coming to the point where suddenly we've seen a lot of traction in the last 2 years, but it's not coming out of nowhere. I think a lot of people have been building heads down in this space way before it was cool to do so.
Great points here. And one of the things that I want to double down is the market opportunity, right? We talked about, the ecosystem kind of like coming together right now to support the break of entrepreneurship in the country. And of course, as we've seen these global narratives play out over the last years in some countries and decades in the other. Now, where's the opportunity here, Misbah? Because we keep talking about the 200 million people or 220 million people to be precise from a Pakistan standpoint. And even when we talk about these large economies, that's kind of like what gets thrown around. Indonesia gets that all the time. India got it. India still gets it. 1.4 billion people population. Middle India is the 700 million opportunity. We talked about it from a China perspective about 15, 20 years ago when the Chinese startup ecosystem was blossoming. Now, building for 220 million people doesn't really mean that every person out of that 220 million is actually going to be an end user. It just talks about the potential, TAM in general. But that is also if you're being completely generalist saying, hey, maybe everybody at some point can become a user of my technology, which in most cases won't happen. That's an ideal case scenario. But when you're looking at it, where are the opportunities right now and what needs to be addressed? This is both an opportunity for budding founders to actually take some cues, especially if they're trying to like understand which sectors to be building into, and at the same time also getting an insight into where the challenges lay within the ecosystem, because it's not easy to go out and build either a consumer company, or especially when you're talking about building enterprise SaaS companies going global out of regions in the Asian subcontinent, because we've seen even India for that matter, just across the border. It's not that we've come out with a lot of enterprise SaaS companies. We've just started our journey. It's just been a few years that India's kind of positioning itself. So we're still playing catch up with a lot of other economies. Like Israel's a great example of a country that's actually built always for the globe. But what I'm really trying to get to here is, it's not easy to build for such a big number. We've seen that from various other countries and economies that have tried sitting with this kind of narrative. So within the Pakistani ecosystem, when you're looking at opportunities today, or you're looking at other funds and giving them any advice, especially the budding few VCs who are entering the market, maybe today or perhaps in the year or two from now, what do they need to be aware about?
Yeah, lots to unpack here. So I think, look, if we look at this year, Pakistan has been showing trends that most other emerging economies have in when they were at this time on their trajectory, which is that some of the early sectors that take off are e-commerce, fintech, and logistics. We often call them like, you know, this is a triangle, it's a troika. They kind of work together. They sort of provide this basic ecosystem. Pakistan is no exception there as well. If we look at how much has been raised in the last year, e-commerce as a sector has seen the most amount of money raised. Fintech is close second, but has seen the most number of deals that have been raising, founders that have been raising money. And then logistics and trucking has been the third sector, but also like the number three. So that's kind of following the pattern that we're seeing in other emerging economies at the time that they were, you know, at this stage of their development as well. I think what taking a step back, what I was mentioning earlier, Akash, is that in a market like Pakistan, in a frontier economy or an emerging economy, there's a lot of opportunity because there's a lot that's broken and there are a lot of gaps. There's a lot of rent-seeking behavior. Markets are inefficient in a lot of cases. And so there is an opportunity to address big problems. You talked about the TAM. We like to invest as I2I Ventures. We like to invest in founders that are solving big problems, that are looking at have-to-haves rather than nice-to-have niche products. I'm not going to be interested in a pizza-making robot, unlike maybe a Silicon Valley VC that may be specializing in that kind of, you know, robotics or technology. For me, founders that are addressing, you know, the $70 billion agriculture market are exciting. The founders, which is like, for example, one of our agri-tech companies, which is called Taza. One of our companies, Creditbook, is looking at providing small and medium enterprises with digitization of their ledger, like similar to Khata Book in India or Buku Cash, Buku Warang in Indonesia. They're looking at a 25 million SME opportunity with around 40 billion in unmet financial needs. Another one of our investee companies is a female first fintech focused on banking and credit and financial services, looking at women. Only 7% of Pakistani women, which is 50% of the population, only 7% of that population even has a basic bank account. So if you look at the kind of opportunities there are in some of these big problems that need to get solved, I think those are the ones where there's an opportunity to grow very fast. And I think those are companies, those are markets that offer a lot of growth potential as well. So, you know, given how big Pakistan is, you mentioned companies that are the countries that are, you know, where ecosystems are focused outward. I think we're starting to see that in Pakistan. We will see companies growing outward from here, both in the region and globally. But I think there's so much untapped opportunity in Pakistan itself in terms of where you can build and where you can grow, that a lot of your initial growth can actually just come from the country. Again, we're much smaller than India, but India is that opportunity, right? Like, why would you need to go outside India when you can cater to a population that, you know, where you understand the market dynamics, you're on the ground, and where there's a big need that you're actually fulfilling. So I think, from the perspective of the kinds of sectors there are, we're also invested in an edtech company. Edtech is huge as an opportunity in Pakistan. And Edcasa is actually focusing on exam prep in that context. So there are opportunities in fintech, in e-commerce that are, you know, not unique to Pakistan, but where the Pakistan opportunity is so big that it's a bit of a no-brainer once you're able to figure out the right way to approach the opportunity. I think we are going to see more activity in each of these sectors, as the market grows. I think there are areas that are, that have done well regionally and globally. Buy now, pay later, for example, is one that, where people are starting to look at the Pakistan opportunity. Quick commerce is another where, again, it's a challenging market, but regionally and globally, companies have raised a lot of money in that space. So there's some interest in Pakistan in that context as well. I think, looking at the B2B opportunity in retail and disrupting the way traditional markets work in terms of getting goods from the manufacturer all the way down to the kiryana store or the retailer is also one where a lot of companies have seen traction in Pakistan, have seen good growth, and have actually raised money as well. So I think some of those areas are going to continue. And it all comes down to what are those large TAMs that people are targeting. And I think, several verticals in fintech, several verticals within e-commerce, and then of course, logistics and education are two of those as well that will, I think, continue to see a lot of opportunity.
These are fantastic points. And I wanted to bring your attention to something that we've seen that's kind of played out in, geographies in Southeast Asia and India. What is kind of like unique to Pakistan also is the fact that you have structural advantage. Pakistan's probably from the outside world, it seems a little more close-knit. There's fewer provinces and states. There are less regulatory barriers. Having a late start from an ecosystem point of view also means that you have a lot of advantages wherein you can look at other people who have made mistakes and say, hey, we don't have to do the same thing that, these guys have done. And we saw that happen a lot, especially in the early days where China kind of like looked at what the US had done and basically built copycat models of that. And, they've done far better than the US companies themselves, Alibaba is a great example of looking at e-commerce in the United States and doing a much better job. And then building a robust infrastructure of payments, of deliveries, of retail, of just taking everything that was offline and converting that to an online model. Now you have that opportunity within Pakistan as well. Now copycats are obviously not bad. Copycats are great, but where copycats actually become even more vital and kind of get really ingrained into an ecosystem is when you're able to add that Desi mix, that uniqueness factor that is kind of like very unique to countries like ours. Adding that local flavor kind of like makes it very, very different. So is that how you also look at the opportunity, saying, hey, if there's a copycat, bring it on, but let's see how well and how best can you adapt it to the current ecosystem and the needs of the market so that we're able to provide something unique and make that experience so unique that it doesn't really relieve the consumer. That's kind of like how you also increase your LTV, right? If you're talking more so from a VC terminology perspective, how difficult and easy is to get nuanced in some of these categories? And how are you seeing entrepreneurs build that narrative as the ecosystem also unfolds in Pakistan to support these new niche sectors, which perhaps may seem small, but at the same time is such an essential component that it can become part of a larger play?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think on the whole copycat aspect, we love it when founders learn from other markets. And yes, you're right, being late to the game also means that you have the ability to look at what others have been through, right? So we've already seen startups, for example, looking at companies in India, which maybe didn't monetize early enough and monetized a lot later, maybe by Series B or C, and then kind of had the pressure of having to monetize after they've sort of been along the road for a while. And so companies are looking at learning lessons from there and saying, okay, what can we do differently to not find ourselves in that position by the time we've raised two more rounds of funding? I think in terms of business models, you hit it on the head, like you have to desiify, right? You have to look at the local context. You have to look at what works in Pakistan. One of our portfolio companies is an earned wage access company. So it's called Abhi, and they help people access their wages, before payday. They studied models in Brazil, in Mexico, in the Middle East, in Philippines, as they were building their own company. And not only did they study those models, but they also have some investors that invested in those companies early on. So what they're able to do is look at the experience of those operators, those founders. And what's really great, Akash, is that we're seeing a lot of Pakistani founders reaching out to other founders and just building that camaraderie, building the community and learning from their experience. you know, our edtech company at Casa reached out, has reached out to founders, like the founder of Topper, for example, in India, and they've engaged on getting feedback and thoughts from them. Our investee company, Taza, which works in agri-tech, I actually connected them via co-investor to somebody at NinjaCart in India. And they've been talking to the founders there and really, you know, learning from their experiences because they're a few years ahead. So the good founders are definitely doing that. And I'm sure, I mean, I'm just talking about my portfolio examples because I see that firsthand. I'm sure there are a number of other founders in the market that are doing this. So not only are they learning, are they being inspired and learning about business models from others, but they're actually actively engaging with founders in similar markets and then tweaking for what needs to be done in Pakistan. And I think that's really the success. You know, Muneeb Meyer, who started Bikea, which is not one of our companies, but, you know, has been a fast growing startup in the mobility space, has been, you know, looking at, you know, what has been built in Southeast Asia and has sort of mimicked that, but really focused on Pakistan and how it gets adopted to the Pakistan market. The app is in Urdu. The engagement with the drivers is very much localized in that context. And so I think that's very important to do. And I think we're going to see more and more of the successful founders building for Pakistan. I heard a friend and a colleague say once that, you know, the Uber of Pakistan is not going to be Uber. It's going to be something that is regional or local, or the Stripe of Pakistan is not going to be Stripe. It's going to be something that's either homegrown or something that is, you know, inspired by what they've seen elsewhere, but then developed for the local market. So I think that's quite important, you know, as you talked about building for the market more broadly and acquisitions. I think one thing I just want to touch upon there is that we haven't yet invested in a company that is in a fintech that's just setting up a neobank. But what we've done is invested in at least two of our fintechs, you know, are building financial services to the extent where they can become neobanks in the future. But they're starting from a product or a service where there is a lot of customer engagement, where there is customer adoption, and building from there. Versus just starting off with saying, I'm just going to build a new bank and I'm going to provide, you know, these five services from day one, from day zero, and then see, you know, if you build it, will they come or not? And I think that's quite thoughtful. So I think that's also something that's important in a market that's so early, is that, you know, you need to work with where the customers are, where the consumers are at in terms of their tech adoption, and see what needs to be built, you know, where you need to be tech first and where you need to be product first, and then let the technology come in with the evolution of the product. And that sometimes means that you can't copy paste a tech product that may have worked elsewhere, but you need to see what your local market needs and build from there.
No, what's also really important to highlight here is how far the broadband penetration or the internet penetration in Pakistan has come along. You know, we've been talking about the 220 million people opportunity, but if you just take a look at where the country was a few years ago, you'd only know that there was little penetration. And today you've got about 110 million, which is almost 50% of the population, which obviously doesn't happen in many countries, especially when, you know, the startup ecosystem begins to boom. So for VCs to kind of be in a market, you need the market to have good startups. But for the startups to be in a hot market, you need there to be capital. Otherwise, they'll move towards markets where there is opportunity to raise that amount of money. So they go hand in hand in some sense. So moving the conversation a little bit away from the landscape to a little bit more around the LP appetite, where does Pakistanis or domestic LPs, let's go with domestic LPs to begin with before we talk about foreign LPs, because I guess as it's easier to understand the foreign narrative given that the amount of money that's kind of lying outside of the country, very similar to India as well. A lot of money for the last 10 years or so has been foreign money that's kind of now seeing some sort of liquidity with IPOs and acquisitions. It's still not domestic capital that has abundantly been invested in the country. Now, very similarly, what do you think about the LP appetite? How have domestic investors looked at ventures and asset class and thought about it? What kind of conversations do you have when you have conversations with your LPs or potential LPs who have looked at your fund or the ones that you're looking to have a conversation with?
Yeah, and you know, Pakistan is really unique that way, because one thing, you know, that I didn't touch upon when we were talking about regulations is that so most of the funds, the VC funds that started in Pakistan started around the time we did, give or take, you know, maybe 5 to 6 months before or after, which is now coming up to just, you know, around 2 years and a bit. And actually, most of us, there are 6-7 of us that started around this time. Almost all of us are domiciled outside the country. And that's primarily because at the time, the VC fund structure, the VC fund regulations were actually not very conducive to setting up in Pakistan. They are a subset of the mutual fund regulations, which are quite onerous because obviously mutual funds take money from the public at large. And there's a lot of, you know, quite heavy regulatory requirements, reporting requirements, and quite constrictive. So actually, most of the VC funds that are investing, even though we have teams on the ground, like I'm fully based in Pakistan and so are several others, they've actually raised money from, they're domiciled outside the country. And then given the foreign exchange situation in Pakistan, they've actually raised most of their money from outside the country as well. And what that really means is that most of us don't have local LPs, which is quite unique, but is also in line with what you're talking about in, you know, when you mentioned India, for example. I think the reason in Pakistan is a little unique to this point that I just made about the regulatory structure. But I think the second aspect of it is about mindset. I think in a market where VC is new, you actually often need people coming from outside who understand VC and understand how the market works to be able to take those first early bets. Now we're starting to see with the kind of activity we have, we're starting to see local investors being like, hey, that's really interesting. You know, if I can actually come in and get these kind of returns or support companies that are growing really fast and are doing really well, you know, why would I not? And so I think what's interesting right now is that, you know, a significant amount has actually of this 350 million that I mentioned this year is actually come from international funds. And even that has come from quote unquote local funds is coming from pools of funds that have been raised internationally. And I think we're going to start seeing some of that continue with more and more international funds looking at Pakistan. But I think we'll start seeing more of a homegrown LP base in Pakistan over the next few years because people are starting to see the opportunity. I think one thing that you know is potentially similar with other regional economies also is that there tends to be a bit of a state mindset or a you know business owner mindset. Multi-generational family owning companies are not used to sharing equity. They're not used to giving up control. And I think a lot of times people have been a little wary of the startup space because they're like, wait a minute, what do you mean I'm not going to own more than 50% of this company when I invest in it? How will I control what the founder does? And that mindset is completely, you know, opposite to what helps startups thrive. And so we have seen some bad investors in Pakistan over the last decade or so, which is why, you know, startups have been held back to a certain extent. I think that's going to start changing. I think more local investors they're already coming in as angels, but we're going to start seeing more LPs and funds that are coming in, as well as investors that are looking at supporting companies independently, individually. I think business houses and large business families are also excited about this opportunity, and everyone's kind of seeing, like, do we set up a fund of our own, or do we come into another fund as an LP? Like, how can we actually be part of this really growing, fast-growing space? I think in terms of regional and global examples, we have those in front of us, you know, and people are starting to see that can be possible in Pakistan as well. So it is an exciting time. It's very early days still. We do hope the momentum continues, but it's definitely an exciting time to be in an ecosystem that's relatively new, but that is seeing exponential growth and getting local investors excited about it as much as foreign investors are right now.
Well, you hit the nail right on top of the head. You know, the ecosystem has just arrived at the global stage and it's the beginning of a new dawn. And
the more people are able to like take notice of this right now, the better it is in terms of getting in on the opportunity, both from a talent perspective, a founder perspective, and of course from LP and VC perspective as well. You know, you've really touched upon a lot of points that kind of give an outsider like me a good glimpse of the opportunity and challenges that currently exist within the ecosystem. And that's really important for anyone to understand any startup landscape. And you've done a fantastic job in doing so. But as I said, you know, we're just getting started. There's a massive opportunity that needs to be addressed here. I'm really, really looking forward to how the narrative plays out in the coming months, because 2022 is going to be a significant year. I feel if the country raised $320 million last year, I think this is going to be a far more significant year, because we will see more companies coming out of the country. Of course, when you have organizations like YC, Kleiner Perkins, Tiger Global, all taking an interest and helping companies grow from a global perspective, there will be a lot more domestic interest that's going to support that as well. And you're at the forefront of it. And I'm really excited to see how this is going to play out, not just this year, but also in the coming few years and perhaps the decade. I want to bring you on at a later stage, perhaps could be as early as towards the end of the year or early next year, and kind of do like a recap of what the previous year was. And this is also something that I've been looking forward to doing with a bunch of VCs here in India, is looking back at 2021 and then just decoding and deciphering the ecosystem for a lot of listeners. And I want to do that with you as well, Ms. Bhav, bring you back early next year so that we can take a look at 2022 as a year that was, and really talk about how far the ecosystem's come along. And I'm very confident that we'll have a lot more insights to really share with the whole world about what's happened in the last 12 months in retrospect. So this has been a great conversation for me personally. This was a quick 101 for me in terms of catching up with the Pakistani landscape, especially from a VC point of view. And I'm looking forward to like more with not just all the guests that come across from the Pakistani VC ecosystem, but also in general, hopefully bringing on some founders and talking to them about the challenges of fundraising and everything that, you know, they can share from their perspective about building companies in the country.
Absolutely, Akash. Thanks for the opportunity to share a little bit about our sort of ecosystem and where things are in Pakistan with you. And I would love to come on again. It would be really interesting, I think, to do a retrospective and see, you know, the conversation we had today and where we are in the market a year from now, or, you know, let's say in another 10, 11 months. So definitely look forward to it. And thanks again for having me on. And I'm really honored that I'm the first Pakistani VC on the Desi VC podcast. And I hope there'll be many more. And thanks so much for the opportunity. I really enjoyed our conversation.
So that brings us to the end of this episode, and Ms. Bhav truly put a spotlight on several aspects surrounding Pakistan's growth story. While the markets and opportunities are still nascent, it is quite evident that there is a lot of a case to be made in the coming years for Pakistan's growth story from a global perspective. I would highly urge you to follow this closely, and as Ms. Bhav rightly put it, the next few years would be a really defining period for the tech ecosystem in Pakistan. Well, if you're like me and you've enjoyed this episode and all the ones that we've been bringing you so far and would like to hear more such guests, do subscribe to the podcast and share it with as many people as you think would enjoy listening to it. It really helps others discover the show, and most importantly, keeps you up to date about all the episodes that we bring straight to your phone. Thanks again for joining me on this episode. Next week, we have another great guest on the show who will shed light on what it means to be both an LP and a GP at the same time. So stay tuned to find out who it is. I'll see you next week here on the podcast. And until then, stay safe, everybody, and keep hustling.